You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Whether you're meeting somebody new or maybe catching up with someone after, say, 10 years, there's a good chance that you'll turn toward the topic of what you do for a living.
What have you been doing with your life?
Professional killer.
Oh, good for you. It's a growth industry.
Your answer may not be as dramatic as John Cusack's there in the movie Gross Point Blank, but our next guest says talking about our jobs, what we do for a living, doesn't always make for the best conversation starter. And we can do better than the what do you do question by digging into other parts of identity when we want to get to know people. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Picture the scene. You're at a party or a dinner or on the sidelines of your kid's big game or hanging out after a worship service. You meet somebody. What do you talk about? Do jobs come up? Do you wish they didn't? What do you like to talk about to get to know someone apart from their job? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Rachel Feinzig is with us. What does she do? She's the Work and Life columnist at the Wall Street Journal. She has a piece this month with the headline, "Stop Telling Everyone What You Do for a Living." Rachel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I've done this, you know, led with what I do or asking what the person does for a living. Why do you think we go there? Why do we reach for that when we're having that conversation with somebody we don't know so well?
It's so hard not to, right? Someone that I interviewed told me that it's like asking about the weather. It's just so natural. So I think most of it is just reflexive. I hesitate to say this. I was telling someone else this today and they said it was a bit of a cynical take, but there's this status competition kind of always humming under the surface, as someone else told me in this story. Maybe we secretly are curious about how much money someone makes, or we're thinking about whether they could help us, you know, in our own career. And so I do think there are other reasons that people sometimes just reach for that question and reasons to move away from it.
Well, I think it, like the weather thing for me, you know, I'm not great at small talk, and this is easy. Like, pretty much everybody's going to have a job or used to have a job or will have a job. It seems like it's at least some kind of common ground. Is that part of why it seems like a natural?
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, especially in this moment where we have a decent number of people, especially in the tech industry, being laid off, it can also bring up a lot of strong emotions for people. So I think you do have to tread lightly, even though it has become definitely, you know, like small talk and a polite topic.
What made you start thinking about alternatives and seeking out alternatives to the what do you do question?
You know, the story just came from this one sentence, what do you do? I just kept coming back to it. I have this kind of, you know, stream of consciousness, big, long document with ideas. And it was just really that phrase. And then I threw it out to, you know, all kinds of people doing all kinds of jobs all over the country. And that's really where the story came from and where I got ideas of better things to say. Like the guy who told me that he leads with a joke. People will ask him what he does, and he says, "I make the little umbrellas that go in tropical drinks." And they're like, "Really?" And he's like, "No, no, not at all." But like, like he said, it just breaks up the conversation. It kind of pulls people out of those rote scripts. And I thought that was really interesting.
Now, you talked to the host, somebody hosts a bunch of dinner parties. It looked like good sized dinner parties. But the deal is there's a ban on this. No talking about your work at this. What did you hear from about how those actually went then?
Yeah, that's the cocktail umbrella guy, John Levy. He said it's really cringeworthy at first. Like, people are often awkward. They avoid, you know, some people hit the alcohol, some people avoid the alcohol because they're scared of what they might say if they don't have this kind of crutch in hand. He told me, this didn't make it into the article, but he told me like the most cringeworthy is when people start comparing the spellings of their name. Like, mm-hmm. Someone will be like, "Oh, like my aunt was Linda with a Y." You know, he's like, you know, that's when you really need to kind of intervene when people just don't know what to say because they're so used to kind of leading with this script. But he said by the end, everyone's like a gang of old camp friends. They're kind of bonded by the fact that they have to talk about their actual interests and kind of deeper parts of who they are.
Talking to Rachel Feinzig with the Wall Street Journal. She had a piece this month about, that question. When you meet somebody new or reconnect with somebody, What do you do? Well, she says, hey, maybe let's talk about something other than our job. We'll probably be happy if we did. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is that your go-to in a conversation in that situation? Or do you have something else you like to bring up and talk about? What is it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I always used to ask people what they did for a living. But now that I'm retired, I find that when I go to the senior center, it's like nobody asks anybody what they do. I mean, eventually I might say, well, what did you used to do? You know, like, well, I used to be a social worker. I used to be a office manager, whatever. But it never comes up in the beginning because people are usually not working anymore.
It's okay if I may ask, and maybe we'll get some inspiration here. What are some of the lead topics that people come up with to talk about when everybody knows everybody else isn't working now?
Well, I think partly people, you ask them if they, of course, this might be familiar, and they might say, well, do you come here often? That sounds like a bar conversation. But
okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And Rachel, yeah, do you come here often? That may not be the best replacement. What kind of things do you find people talking about if they say, okay, no, we're not going to do the what do you do, not do the job conversation?
Well, do you come here often actually isn't a terrible starting point, this idea of asking people, like talking about where you are and what's going on and what brought them to this, you know, place where you're now meeting is something people mentioned to me. Also asking, how do you fill your time? What brings you joy? Leading with books or movies or vacations, things kind of outside of your work and professional life is where people, you know, told me they're trying to start now.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kay, at 800-642-1234. And Rachel, part of this boils down to something you've written about before, and that's how much our job defines our identity, not to other people, but to ourselves. How, and you've experimented with this some, how can we move away from defining ourselves to ourselves by the job we're doing?
Yeah, this has been a huge topic for me. I wrote a piece last year where I talked about my own journey with running and how just having a hobby, something that was just for me, that was outside of my work, and in that case, also outside of my life as a parent of young kids, was just made me feel like a different person and gave me something else to talk about with people. So I think just having a life can be really helpful. Like, you have to have a life outside of work in order to talk about something outside of work. And so then it kind of feeds on yourself and your identity becomes less looped to, you know, how you get your paycheck.
Yeah. Do you get the sense that part of why we talk about our job is that we worry that that other stuff isn't as central to who we are? The job is the big thing, the main part of our identity that other people are going to care about?
Yeah, I think it happens because we spend so many hours of our life at work. I think it happens because so much of our confidence might come from work. One person told me she would ask people what they did because she was secretly hoping they would ask her, because saying what she did made her feel like she was someone worth talking to. And so I think a lot of us do kind of tie our jobs to our value as a person. And it can be really tough to realize, like, no, I have to figure out how to be a person without this fancy job title.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Carol is with us now in Madison. Carol, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'd kind of discovered this a long time ago. I didn't go to college, and all of my friends did. And I learned to not ask about their, you know, school, because I didn't want to have them ask me the same thing. I learned to say, what do you like to do? And one thing I wanted to also comment on is people are surprised when you say that. When you don't ask what do you do, sometimes they'll actually answer what they do for work before they even realize that you didn't ask. And I love the conversation. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, Carol, I want to ask, do people have something ready to go? Are they so, or do they have to think for a minute? What do I like to do?
Yeah, they always pause and take a breath and then they answer because they're not used to that question. Huh? It's fun.
What do you like to do, Carol?
oh, I like to sing and dance and play music with my friends and garden, all sorts of things.
Awesome conversation starters, Carol. Thanks a lot for that. And Rachel, is this the kind of thing, like at the dinner party we were talking about, is what Carol brings up the kind of thing we end up talking about if we take work off the dinner table?
Absolutely, ideally. And just deeper things, like more points of connection between people, real points of connection, not just like, oh, I also, you know, like do Excel spreadsheets or, you know, I'm trying to wrangle everyone to that Zoom meeting. But like real things that make us feel like fuller human beings and really connected to people in a way that, I mean, sometimes our jobs can, I think, like, I think it's okay for your job to be part of your identity. But I think when we go deeper, it can bring just a lot more life and depth to a conversation.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, about things to talk to people about when we meet them or reconnect after a long time, apart from our jobs, apart from what we do for a living, which is often, understandably, what we go to first. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you meet somebody, do you like having that conversation about your job and their job, or do you try to get into other topics? If so, what are those other topics? And do you feel like your job defines who you are in large part? Are you cool with that? Is that good? Or do you think maybe you need some other stuff out there to talk about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at The Wall Street Journal, talking about what we talk about when we meet somebody new or catch up with someone. Her suggestion, we can have better conversations, get to know each other better, if we don't start with talking about our jobs and avoid that question, what do you do? Call in now at 800-642-1234. What do you do when you're having that conversation? What do you ask about? Do jobs come up? Is that cool? Do you like to talk about different stuff? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Delafield. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm just going to try and interject a bit of humor to this. And that is, you know, I'm sure you've watched Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. You remember the episode when George was trying to date a woman and impress her? And what did he tell her? He told her he was a marine biologist. I might do that going forward, kind of like the first guy he made the little umbrellas.
Right. Mark, thanks for the call. I don't remember that episode. I'm guessing being Seinfeld, it worked perfectly with absolutely no downside. But Rachel, there's that temptation for somebody who's doing a job that people might perceive as a cool job to want to talk about that job and maybe, like you were saying earlier, want people to ask them what job they're doing and maybe not make something up like marine biologist.
It's totally understandable. And yet I think one of the risks is, especially today and in this specific economy, many jobs are not forever. And so then the hard part becomes like, who are you if you don't have that job anymore for whatever reason? And I think a lot of people struggle with that. Or who are you if the job starts burning you out and you're miserable and you don't want to be reminded of it, you know, every time you go to a dinner party? I think it can really, you know, blur those lines in a way that can be difficult for some people.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I took a psychology class when I was working on my undergrad at UWM, and we had to ask our other classmates three questions without asking them about, you know, themselves specifically, but to find out information. And one of the questions that I came up with was, I like to ask people if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want and why? Because if somebody says, I'd want to be invisible because, you know, that way I can move around and no one would see me, that's more or less somebody who's probably not feeling seen or heard in the world. Where if you have somebody else where they say, I want to be invisible so that I can rob banks or I can sneak around. And, you know, that's more, there's more larceny operating in that one. And I'd be a little cautious.
And Marcus, do you do this? That was in the class. Do you do this in a conversation now with the superpower question?
All the time. All the time. Yeah. I find it's a great way to find out about somebody's personality. And it's such a strange question, or, you know, that some of the answers that you get too, I had one guy said that he wants the ability to be able to pick up and play any musical instrument ever. Ooh. Because he loves music and he thinks it makes people happy, where I myself would want the ability to read and speak any language ever, because Ooh. Museums would be fantastically interesting to me.
Marcus, thanks. You may have given us an idea for a college segment in the future. That's fantastic, Marcus. Rachel, there are some creative questions there. What do you think?
I love that. I absolutely love that. I think there's probably this moment, and a few of the viewers have described this moment where people are just so used to kind of going into their shtick that they're probably like super thrown off right at first. But I imagine, you know, you just get the most fascinating answers. What a study in human psychology.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that. At 800-642-1234, talking to Rachel Feinzig with the Wall Street Journal, talking about what we talk about when we meet new people. A lot of times we'll go to the job question. She says we could try a lot of other stuff too and maybe learn more, get to know each other better. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to say, I just think it's in human nature that I want to know about what a person does with their spare time during the day. I find it that I'm always curious of what do you do for a living? Because that lets me know what their interest is as well. So when I'm like in a ski club, I mean, you would be surprised the amount of diversity of different people that are in one club with the same interests.
Interesting, Gary. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Now, in that case, Rachel, they're all there for one reason, skiing. So they know there's a shared interest. Gary wants to know, what they do in their day job, but they're not having fun skiing. I mean, you're not saying never ask about a job here.
No, I'm definitely not saying never. And look, as someone whose job is to be the work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, I love hearing about what people do. I mean, that's why I have this job, right? I find it inherently interesting. I think especially people are kind of in a situation like skiing where maybe they are a little bit more relaxed and they're not just peacocking or trying to impress you, you know, at the elementary school, you know, parents' night or something. You might get some interesting anecdotes by talking about your job. And I do think that a lot of us, like, we derive a well-deserved confidence from our job. I talked to someone for the story who was the first in her family to go to college, and she loves talking about her work because it's this huge accomplishment that she has achieved. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Skip is with us now in Abbotsford. Skip, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today? We're doing good ourselves.
Good.
I'm a traveling folk singer storyteller. I'm on the road right now. And when I am in that position, no matter where it is, my question to somebody is, where are you from?
All right. And do you get good conversations out of that, Skip?
Oh, incredible. And if it isn't, well, I'm from, where are you originally? And they'll tell me, and I've met people that grew up not far from me, or we traveled in similar circles, and just met most amazing people, some of whom I've put some songs together about, simply by asking, where are you from?
Skip, thanks a lot. Have a good tour. What do you think, Rachel? Where are you from?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, as someone who is mostly grounded in place on the East Coast with two little kids, I feel like I live vicariously by asking people, you know, where, like, what the weather looks like outside in Southern California and about their travels. And yeah, I love it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Andy in La Crosse, who couldn't stay on the line. He says he had a teacher who would ask people, what's your story? I don't know. I don't know how I'd react to that, Rachel. I mean, I would need like a week or something to answer that. What do you think? Is that too much?
I mean, I'm here for it. And yet, yeah, I feel like it could like devolve into a therapist type situation, right? Like, you know, if someone wants to hear about like their entire upbringing and like all the issues that I have with my mother, it could go in that direction. But no, I like it. I think it's a nice way because people can take that whatever direction they want, right?
Definitely. Now, I got to ask, have you, I mean, you meet people through your work a lot, but in your personal life, have you made a switch or do you still find yourself, Rachel, falling into, you know, what do?
I'm trying not to do it. Ever since starting this story, I am trying not to do it. I also, there was some advice from a career coach in the piece about how to introduce yourself. And you could say something, you know, like list a couple of hobbies, some personal things about yourself, and then include your job as almost an afterthought. So, you know, you're still kind of like maybe abiding by that social expectation, but it's kind of like a last beat, you know, in my day job, to earn a living, which I thought was a good idea. And I've been trying to do that as well.
All right. And have you tried anything that's just fallen flat? Like, this seemed like a great conversation starter and no?
I think a lot of it depends on the person you are. I haven't been able to do the what brings you joy. I just think I'm like slightly too sarcastic to pull that one off. But someone nicer than me probably could make it happen.
Yeah, story of my life too. Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Been talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal. She joined us for a look at her column on, you know, conversations. When you meet somebody for the first time, catching up with somebody in the past, what do you talk about? She says we can have a lot of great conversations if we don't go to that tried and true, what do? Or what do you do for a living? Or what's your job? Or lead with your job. Now, this is maybe not fair. I like talking about my job because my job is talking to people who are like really smart and interesting. And then when people find that out, there's like this halo effect where I fool them into thinking that I'm smart and interesting too. So I don't know. It doesn't work out so bad for me. Still time to share your experiences. What is your best conversation starter when you meet somebody new? Give us the line at 8ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And let us know how it works. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever tried to learn a new language? Maybe you did it in school. Maybe you're in the process of learning one right now. Even if it was a challenge, research from around the world shows it's worth the effort. Being multilingual can boost everything from our creativity and critical thinking to our cognitive health. Our next guest has spent years studying the connection between language and the brain, and that's the subject of her new book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with more than one language? Have you taken language classes as a kid or a grown-up? What was the best way for you to learn that second language? Did it come naturally? Or are you like me, and it's tough to learn another language? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Viorica Marianne is the Ralph and Jean Sundin Endowed Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. Viorica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we dig into the benefits of learning more languages, this is your life's work in a lot of ways. What is it that you find so fascinating about the connection between language and our brains?
I've always loved languages and been interested in the relationship between language and mind. I think most people think about us, our brains producing language, and don't understand that this relationship between language and mind is bidirectional. The languages we use also shape the way we think, shape our minds and our brains. So growing up with more than one language, I've always been interested in this relationship between mind and language.
Let's talk a little bit about how our brain handles language. There was some thought, I think, that, hey, here's a language center for our brains. And as we like analyze and scan our brains, we're going to figure out where language is coming from. If I'm reading you right, Viorica, it's a lot more complicated than that. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. So I actually myself, when I first started, was, you know, almost 30 years ago, was interested in seeing whether one language is located in one part of the brain and another language in another part of the brain. And that's a question I get asked often. But it turns out the brain is a much more distributed network of processing. So both languages share much of this network, and language itself is this broad network of activation in various areas of the brain that change depending on whether we comprehend language, produce language, whether we're focusing on meaning or form or syntax. So it's really a very complex neural activity.
Now, a lot of the history of the study of language has been on people who maybe speak only one language, like me. You and some of your colleagues are expanding that. What kind of things are we starting to learn about language by studying people like you who grew up with more than one language?
Well, you know, I think that if we only study monolingual brains and monolingual minds, we're missing a big part of the picture. And we're getting an incomplete and really inaccurate understanding of the human potential, of the potential of the human mind. And I think about this as being similar to how in the field of medicine, heart disease at one point was studied only in men and later found to be manifesting differently in women, or diabetes was studied primarily in white populations, only to later discover that the indigenous populations of North and South America process sugar differently. In the same way, if we only study monolingual brains, we are really leaving out a lot of important information out. And especially considering that, in fact, the majority of the world's population outside the United States is bilingual and multilingual. So it's very, very common in many countries all around the world to grow up with more than one language. And even in the United States, those numbers are changing. So it is increasingly becoming important to not limit our research to a very small, narrow subset of what are called weird populations that represent only a small, so weird because they are coming from white, educated, industrialized, and rich democratic nations, which are the minority of the world's population. So in order to really understand the human mind, the human potential, we need to expand our definition of that.
Talking to Viorica Marian. Her new book is called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're trying to learn a new language right now, we'd love to hear about that. If you grew up speaking more than one language, what was that like for you? How did it shape the way you think, or the way you think you think? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into multilingual people here, Viorica. And one thing people might wonder about is for kids, the worry, and I wondered about this too, the worry that, okay, if a kid is brought up with two languages at the same time, are they going to be confused? Is it going to slow down their language growth? You have a pretty solid answer on this one in the book.
Yeah, that's a very common misconception. We often think that, and even advise people not to raise children with more than one language. And there is absolutely no evidence for that. Our human brain is built to be able to handle multiple codes of communication. And if you think of codes of communication as going beyond language and including other symbolic systems like math, like music, like nonverbal communication, you can see that the brain is able to seamlessly learn and integrate and master all these forms of communication. So multiple natural languages can be accommodated just as well. And you can see this in children and in infants all around the world growing up with multiple languages. And in the United States, we often see differences across socioeconomic classes. So upper classes, upper middle classes usually understand the benefit of raising children with multiple languages, and often, sign them up for lessons, language lessons, or hire tutors, or send them on programs abroad, and really understand that being bilingual and multilingual has all these benefits, economic benefits, social benefits, lifelong wonderful outcomes. and encourage that. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we often have groups that are the lowest social economic status that are actively discouraged from speaking another language under the assumption that that's damaging or confusing or bad for them. And there is, again, no evidence for that. And a lot of those recommendations come from biases that are really rooted in something else rather than really language.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Coon Valley. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Well, I'm just curious what your speaker's advice would be about the older people. I'm talking about retired people. What would be the best way for them to learn another language? Because there's many of us who did not have language when we were younger, variations of language. So I'm wondering what she thinks is the best route to go to learn another language.
Great question, Susan. Virika, what advice do you have for Susan?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this topic, Susan. It's actually an excellent topic. And before I go into the how, if you would let me, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the benefits for aging
please.
And the aging brain. Yeah, so we now know that individuals who know two or more languages tend to develop dementia, Alzheimer's, and other types of dementia on average 4 to 6 years later than individuals who only speak one language. And countries that are bilingual or multilingual have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's. So it really does seem to be the case that having multiple languages and giving your brain this constant workout of juggling multiple languages translates to positive neural and cognitive health outcomes later in life, what's known as cognitive reserve and neural reserve. And the analogy I like to give is if you imagine taking a certain road home every day for many years, and then one day on your way home, that road collapses. If there are other roads that have been built to your house over the years, you will have no problem rerouting and getting to your destination. But if that's the only road that has been built, then you are in trouble. And in the same way, when you have multiple languages, if one neural pathway in the brain has been impacted and is no longer available to you, because you have multiple languages that have built memories, associations, experiences over the years, you are able to rely and compensate functionally for that anatomical deterioration. So it's a wonderful thing to learn another language as you get older. As far as how to do it, the one thing I would say is to choose something that you can engage in long-term, every day, systematically. So it's something that's sustainable. And then from there, choose a way that works best for your personality. Some people prefer to engage in social interaction on learning language, so maybe trade language lessons with someone. Some people prefer to do it on their own online. You can also trade language lessons online or use apps. There is a variety of apps right now that are built in a way that takes advantage of game design and rewards learning with all sorts of badges and pings and really gets the serotonin and endorphins and all the positive chemicals going, so you are motivated and inclined to keep up with your lessons. So whatever really is likely to get you to continue and stay with your practice will be very helpful. Make sure you do it regularly. And from there on, the only other thing to consider is just really think about what language you're most likely to find an affinity for. Is this a language that maybe means something for you because of your personal and family background, or because you have people you'd like to communicate with in that language, or you'd like to travel to that country, or you'd like to watch entertainment, consume entertainment in that language? So if you have something to which you're connected and you do this because you enjoy it rather than yet another thing to do, if you make it an enjoyable, pleasant activity, then you're much more likely to stick with it. And that's what it comes down to, like exercise or investing or anything else. If you do it long-term, little by little, it's eventually going to produce the benefits that you're looking for.
Susan, thanks for calling. Hope that helps. We're talking to Virika Marion, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University. She's the author of the new book, The Power of Language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about speaking more than one language. If you do personally speak more than one, when and how did you learn them? Did you grow up, or did you learn them in school or on the job or in a foreign country? Let us know. If you're like me and tried and, you know, only sort of succeeded, you could share that story too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Viorica Marian, professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northwestern University, talking with her about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, about language, our brains, and the benefits of learning a second or third or fourth language. You could join in with your own story or your questions at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi. Just wanted to let you know that in Milwaukee, for many years now, at least since the early 90s when my kids started going to these schools, we have at least four language immersion schools, Italian, I believe, German, French, and Spanish. And they learn in four-year-old kindergarten, five-year-old kindergarten, first and second grade. I believe they're only taught in the second language, whether it's German or Spanish or French. And then they're taught in both languages. And they learn to speak, to communicate with the teacher in the second language. And then when they're tested at fourth grade for the reading levels, they score way at the top, if not first place.
Wow.
In the state or scores. So you don't have to worry about them having problems later in learning because they learn very well.
I gotcha, Mike. Thanks for that call. Viorica, in our schools here in the U.S., often you don't have a foreign language option until high school. Some people like me don't hit one until college. What do you think of this idea, like as Mike talks about, starting early, much earlier, with something like an immersion school?
Yeah, there are multiple types of bilingual education, but the two-way immersion approach that Mike just mentioned is one of the best ways to bring up children with multiple languages. And by the end, they are fluent in both languages. And Mike is right. There are data suggesting that they score higher on reading and math scores, and this is true for both students from the language majority culture as well as for students from the language minority culture. So you see academic benefits, but you also see social, interpersonal, and personal benefits in terms of interpersonal skills, identity, self-confidence. It just seems to be a really beneficial way of raising children with two languages and results in fluency. So it's a wonderful model. It's very rare because it's more expensive to support, but it is absolutely an excellent way of growing up with two languages. And like we said before, in many countries around the world, it's the norm to grow up with more than one language. So my native language is Romanian. That's the language I spoke at home. And then the official language at the time I was growing up, because it was I'm from the eastern part of Romania, from Moldova, that was a Soviet republic. It was a Soviet territory, so Russian was the official language. And then English, and then a few other languages sort of get picked up. And then on my husband's side of the family, he grew up with Dutch as the native language, but also is fluent in English, German, some Spanish, some French. And that's really the norm in many places. So it can be a really enriching both linguistically and culturally and interpersonally experience.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Before I go back to our callers, Viorica, that you just reminded me of something that I think I learned from your book. You know, the second language is one thing, but that makes it easier to learn language number three, and then that makes it easier to learn language number four. Do I have that right?
Yes, you're right. With each new language you learn, it becomes easier and easier to learn more languages.
Why?
We don't exactly know. There are a number of ideas and theories. Partly it's because you just get better at learning, you know what to pay attention to. You also are better at controlling competition from the languages you already know and interference. But also with each new language, you have less new information to learn. So when you first learn a new language, there's just so much to learn from, you know, rules of grammar and and meaning and form to meaning mapping, then when you learn a second language, some of those grammatical rules are going to be the same. So you do learn, and even some words will be the same. So you learn new information, but not as much as the first time around. And then as you learn a third language, this third language will overlap in some ways with the first language, in some ways with the second language, with some in some ways with both. So if you think of it in terms of Venn diagrams, with each new language, your total surface of the Venn diagram circles grows, but the unique circle, unique surface that's specific to just one of those circles becomes smaller and smaller. So learning promotes learning, and with new learning, you sort of become better at learning. It's not just for language in general. Sort of learning is this virtuous cycle. The more you learn, the better you get at learning.
Talking to Viorica Marianne about her new book, The Power of Language. Back to your calls now. Robin is with us in Delafield. Robin, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just want to say I am 56, and I have a daughter who has lived in Sweden for 6 years. She's now a Swedish citizen, and I decided about a year ago to start studying Swedish. And it's just been, it's like I consider it like my brain workout. it's been so challenging, but it's like in a really good way and frustrating too at times, just because when you just talked about learning other languages, literally there are times when I answer questions in my class, just like yes or no questions, I tap into my high school Spanish. It's hilarious, like what it starts to unlock in your brain when you do learn other languages, like other things pop up. But I have to say, I am all for learning other languages because, like you just said, it is such a good thing for our overall learning. And I feel like it's keeping me younger. And then it's also just providing me a level of comfort. You know, when I travel to visit my daughter, everyone speaks English in Sweden. But, you know, the whole culture and everything in writing is in Swedish. So it's just kind of a nice thing to have.
Robin, thanks so much for sharing that story. Viorica, Robin says her Spanish pops back when she's learning Swedish. I had that. I was never so good at German as when I was trying to learn Polish. What's happening in our brains when we're reaching for that new language we're trying to learn and it reaches back to that one we tried to learn before?
Yeah, thanks. And Robin's experience is wonderful to hear about. She is right to describe that's the word she used, brain workout. And that's exactly really, in a way, what happens. Your brain has to constantly work out to control competition from all these languages to make sure that you are using the language you need to be using and not the other languages. Cognitive, like right now I'm speaking to you in English, I have to make sure my cognitive control mechanisms doesn't let Romanian or Russian or French or Spanish pop out because they don't do us any good. So your brain is constantly working out. And what's really nice about that is that unlike other types of cognitive exercise that people often engage in, like word puzzles or Sudoku, which, you know, of course are wonderful and fun. In those cases, you have to take time out of your life to actively do those. But once you're fluent in another language, your brain constantly gets that exercise just by your way of being in the world, because you're constantly facilitating or co-activating, you know, prioritizing one language and then controlling interference from the other language, whether you are speaking, listening to music, reading, whatever you are doing, you have to juggle multiple languages. So it's a constant workout, which is why it's just such an enriching experience. But yes, Robin is right that all languages are co-activated in parallel. So our brain has to make sure it controls co-activation.
Thanks for that call, Robin. Just briefly, Viorica, you talk about languages. You know, we think of English and Swedish and Spanish and so on. But you also talk about music and computer programming and poetry as kinds of language. In just our last minute, how do they resemble those other things we think of as languages?
Yeah, that's a great question, because of course they are different in so many ways. But one thing that they have in common is that they're all symbolic systems. They all use symbols, which is what languages are, to encode, transmit, and decode information. As I'm speaking to you now, my brain uses the symbolic system of language to encode my ideas, to encode my thoughts into words, transmit them to you, and then your brain decodes them into ideas again and thoughts to be able to comprehend what I'm saying. The same thing happens with math, where we encode complex ideas into simple notations, with music to really transmit information across time and space. So that's one of the wonderful things that languages enable us to do, including artificial languages like computer languages.
Eureka, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
That's Eureka Marian, Professor of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northwestern University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called The Power of Language, How the Codes We Use to Think, Speak, and Live Transform Our Minds. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we spend the majority of our time in childhood around our immediate family, our parents, and our siblings, if any. Those relationships have a big influence on our development as we transition from childhood to teen years into our adult lives. A growing field of studies exploring the exact role that sibling relationships or being an only child can have on our personalities, our resilience, and our social dynamics. Our next guest is working on that research to help better understand how our families bond and how our bonds can make us who we are. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you were an only child or came from a big crew, how do you think that affected your childhood? How did your siblings or lack of siblings shape the person you are today? Tell us your best sibling story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anna Lindell is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater, where she researches child development and the role that parent and sibling relationships play in healthy development. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's great to be here today.
All right. We have a lot of close relationships potentially in our lives. What is unique about a sibling relationship from your perspective as a psychologist?
Yeah, well, compared to all of the relationships that we have in our lifetime, siblings are, if we have siblings, they can be one of the longest lasting relationships that we have. There's a quote that I love that says that our friends come and go, our parents eventually leave us, but our siblings are often the ones that we spend the majority of our lifespan with. And they're also kind of this quintessential love-hate relationship. So there are some very unique dynamics that we really don't see in any other close relationships that we have.
What are some of the big things you look for when it comes to how sibling relationships change over time, you know, from childhood through teen years and into adulthood?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the things that really influence the way that sibling relationships change is we have to think about how people change as they move through childhood and adolescence and into adulthood. And we have different kind of developmental tasks that we're all working on during those times. And our siblings kind of follow along with us. And so if we're thinking about really young children who have a sibling, obviously, those two young children, they might spend a lot of time together, be very companionate with each other. But then as we start to get older, we start to maybe move away from our siblings a little bit and focus more on other relationships. So it can be pretty interesting to see the ways that those dynamics shift.
One assumption that I think was around for a long time, and if I understand correctly, research doesn't bear it out, is that there's something about only children that not having siblings leads to certain personality traits, personality types, often over time viewed with suspicion. Is there anything at all to that, Anna?
Not in my current research. I would say that siblings, the way that we think about these relationships, they serve as an important support role for people. And if children are only children, they will ideally find that support in other relationships that they have. They might spend more time learning from their parents or from their peers, but if you have siblings, that can be a really rich source of socialization and support.
We are talking about siblings, our relationships with them, what they mean for our development as people. Anna Lindell is with us, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. She researches this, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have siblings, how has your relationship with them changed at different parts of your lives? Have they been an important part of your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an only child, do you wish you'd had siblings, as people might expect you to, or did you not see what the big deal was all about? 800-642-1234 is the number. Getting into how sibling relationships work, Anna, what are some of the characteristics of a strong, healthy sibling relationship?
Yeah, well, one of the unique things about sibling relationships is they are such a stable relationship that they can really withstand a lot and still end up okay in the end. So what we often look for in healthy sibling relationships, when children are younger, when they're in adolescence, we're looking for a lot of positive qualities. So are siblings spending a lot of time together, but is that time meaningful? Is there this expectation that that sibling will be there for them no matter what? Is there affection in that relationship? Is there nurturance in that relationship? Do siblings feel like they can trust and support one another? And even if siblings do have conflict, that's very typical. And it really just kind of shows how close those siblings are, because if we kind of think about the kinds of conflicts that children and adolescents have with their siblings, we're typically talking about squabbles that would come up just by virtue of being under the same roof. So that's not necessarily indicative of a poor sibling relationship. It's very expected and also provides a lot of training ground for how to resolve conflicts effectively.
When might a parent or someone look at a sibling relationship, maybe of their kids, and say, wait, this is above and beyond. This is not normal squabbles. This is actually something negative that we got to worry about.
Yeah, I think it comes down to looking at the balance between how frequently are those conflicts occurring, how intense are the conflicts. So if conflicts are very frequent, but also especially intense, without a whole lot of those other positive qualities going on, that could be a time where we might take a look at if there's something we can do to help maybe strengthen those relationships and maybe shift some of those relational qualities around a little bit. But frequent conflicts are not particularly problematic. We know that during late parts of middle childhood, early adolescence, siblings are going to fight. They're trying to assert their autonomy. They're trying to get their equal share. And so having frequent conflicts on their own, not particularly problematic in the long run.
For siblings who have had a difficult, maybe more than usual squabbling type of relationships as kids, what kind of things can they do as grownups when they've got some distance from that to reconnect and maybe confront and overcome those negative years?
Yeah, and there's actually been some research that we've done that's kind of looked at some of these changes after siblings do move apart from one another. So even if siblings maybe had pretty frequent conflicts when they were under one roof together during adolescence, we often find that having just some physical separation from their sibling can often be kind of a catalyst for restarting some of those relationships. And sometimes what we find is if siblings had a very negative relationship when they were living together, sometimes that might mean that those siblings do drift apart a little bit after they do separate, but sometimes it can also create a new opportunity to kind of rekindle that relationship, start to recognize what they value in that relationship once they've had a little bit of time to take a step back.
One thing I wonder about, my brother and I are about 5 years apart, and we were in different worlds as kids. We get along really well now. My daughters are twins, so they're minutes apart. Does the difference in age have a big bearing on how sibling relationships work?
Absolutely. So we absolutely find that siblings who are closer in age, they have a lot more overlap in shared activities that they enjoy. They're more likely to maybe share friend groups, share similar interests. They might attend the same schools even. And so we often find that those siblings tend to have closer relationships, also maybe more conflictive relationships. Whereas if we have siblings who are farther apart in age, we're often going to see maybe more of kind of like a junior parent type of relationship, at least when they're younger, because there is such a difference in maturity level and life experiences. And then those differences don't seem to make quite as much of a difference once we reach adulthood.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater psychology professor Anna Lindell about the way our siblings could shape our childhood and development and how those relationships change over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have siblings? How have you stayed in touch over the years? Are you close friends, whether you are right next door to each other these days or live in different parts of the country or the world? Did having siblings make life easier or more difficult for you growing up? If you're an only child, same question. Did you think that was easier, harder, or it's just what it was? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Anna Lindell. She's a psychology professor at UW-Whitewater. She's with us today to talk about siblings and how having siblings or not having them can influence our development from being kids through our adult lives and the relationships that we have with them through the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to give a shout out to the brother or sister in your life, how your relationship has changed over time, how you stay in touch, maybe even if you've moved apart geographically? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, Rob. Yeah. So this is a little more about, I guess, uncles and less my siblings, but I heard your guest talking about, I think it was twins or siblings who are closer in age earlier, and it reminded me of my Irish twin uncles who, you know, looked almost identical. They were short, blonde, blue boys, and they were really close together. They don't look that way anymore, believe me, but those guys were always doing stuff together. And I think until my older uncle was going into first grade and my younger uncle into kindergarten, my younger uncle thought that they were in fact twins until my older uncle's first grade teacher came up to him and said, "Sorry, Paul, you and Tom are not twins," Paul being the younger of the two uncles. And so that always struck me.
That's a great family story, Jack. Thanks a lot for that at 800-642-1234. Very close in an earlier generation, Anna. Have we seen changes in the closeness of our sibling relationships over the generations?
You know, that's an interesting question. And that's one that I think we'd have to think more about in terms of what part in the lifespan we're talking about. So I think if we're thinking about maybe older adolescents, now we see a lot more reliance on peer relationships and friendships and spending a lot of time outside of the home context in among today's adolescents. And so I think we might see maybe siblings perhaps spending less time together among today's adolescents. We certainly see changes in how likely it is that siblings will see each other frequently once they reach adulthood, as we kind of have people spreading out geographically more than in the past. But it's an interesting question historically to think about how these have changed over time. Yeah.
Jack, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk about siblings, hoping you can answer some of the questions that our guest, Anna Lindell from UW-Whitewater, just brought up. Do you feel like it's easy to stay in touch with your siblings? Is it something you want to do? Do you get a lot of joy from being in contact with your siblings? Does it seem like we do less of that over time? And hey, parents out there, if you have stories of your kids and how they get along as siblings, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anna, what kind of things are you focusing your research on right now when it comes to sibling relationships?
Yeah, well, for a long time, we really didn't have much of a sense of how siblings maintain their relationships once they're no longer living under the same roof. And so what my current research is trying to do is trying to figure out, well, how do siblings best stay in touch with one another? And what benefits can siblings have once they may no longer be spending as much time together. So I'm really particularly interested in how college-aged siblings maintain their relationships and how sometimes we forget that siblings can be a really important resource for students who have siblings, particularly if we're thinking about first-generation college students who may not have parents or many other family members who've gone through the college experience before. Siblings might be a particularly valuable source of information, source of support that might help mitigate some of the challenges that first-gen students often have.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Rhinelander. John, hi.
Hi. I'm hearing a lot of sunshine going on about siblings. I grew up in a family that was rife with alcoholism, violence, and sexual abuse, which you would think would draw siblings close together. I have four siblings. None of us have spoken to each other in probably 10 or 15 years. Two or three of us actually actively detest each other. I don't. I am kind of sad that that's how it ended up, but just another direction.
John, thank you so much for being willing to share that with us. And I'm sorry things went that way. John brings up something I was hoping to get to, Anna. Things don't always work well. There are families that are very dysfunctional and have bad things going on. What do you look for in those kinds of sibling relationships?
Yeah, and in situations like that, we often find that when families are experiencing significant levels of stress, especially chronic stress, we can find sibling relationships can kind of go one of two different ways. So there's been a good amount of research looking at divorce as one context that has found that sometimes siblings, in light of that major life stressor, sometimes it pulls siblings closer together, but in many cases, it does lead siblings to kind of separate from one another. And that's a lot of that has to do with the particular circumstances surrounding the events in the family, but a lot of it also has to do with how close the siblings were kind of in the first place. So sometimes if siblings were very close, they might lean on each other. In other cases, they may not see their siblings as a particularly valuable source of support. And so we can absolutely see some of those types of events leading to separation from siblings, more feelings of indifference towards siblings, feelings of antagonism and dislike of siblings. So we can absolutely see it going either direction, yes.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Anna Lindell, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. She researches, among other things, sibling relationships, what they mean for us as we develop from kids into adults. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Morning, afternoon. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Jim?
Well, all I want to tell you is I come from a large family. There was nine of us. We're nine within 14 years, but we're all in our 60s and 70s now. We're all different, yet we're very close. You know, it could be if somebody from the old neighborhood died or passed away or moved someplace, I could go be away from my phone for an hour and come back, and it's like a pack of firecrackers going off in my pocket because there's so many texts going back and forth.
And Jim, do you live? Do the nine of you live all over the country now, or are you mostly here in Wisconsin? How does that affect things?
Mostly in the Midwest. You know, if there's a gathering, we probably get together, for, I don't know, 3 to 5, 6 times a year. And if there's a gathering, it's, you know, there's probably seven of us that show up anyway.
Interesting. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that. Glad you're still in touch with everybody. A big group of siblings there, Anna.
Yeah, and I love that sibling context that the caller described, because what we often find is, especially once people kind of get into past the early part of adulthood, we often find siblings rekindling those relationships again, and they can be a great source of support and companionship, and it's almost like they pick up right where they left off, despite all of the busyness that we often get in earlier parts of adulthood. We absolutely find siblings maintaining those close relationships, and today it's even easier than ever to keep those ties close with all the forms of technology that we have. It's really exciting.
Jim, thanks for that call. Susie is with us now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. My parents considered it extremely important for us to get along, the four of us kids. I'm number three out of the four within 5 years, and we're in that time zone where everybody just had a pile of kids all at once. Anyway, we passed that on to our children. I had two little kids. when they were little, if they argued with each other, and they got along real well most of the time, but if they got into an argument and I had enough of it, then I would say, all right, you two, hold hands, look at each other in the eye, and you have to say two things about each other that you really like, but it can't have anything to do with how they look. And so they'd have to stand there until they could actually say the two things, and it was always so cute. But they only got to do it a couple of times because after they realized that I was serious about this and I was going to keep doing it, they would they started arguing. I'd come in the room, they'd go, oh, wait, don't argue, because Mama's here. She's going to make us do that again. And so they didn't have to do it very often, but they're still, they're 39 and 36 and a half, and still very, very dear friends, even though one lives in Tulsa and the other one lives in Washington State.
Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Anna, whether it's Susie's example or something else, are there things that parents can do to help cultivate happy relationships among their kids?
Yeah, and especially thinking about how parents can kind of foster those positive sibling relationships, we absolutely find that parents should celebrate and acknowledge their children's differences among one another. Some of the callers have mentioned how they're very different, but also very similar. And I think that parents really should work very hard not to compare their children with one another, and really kind of acknowledge what makes each of their children unique, because then that'll reduce the possibility of sibling rivalry. Siblings will feel less like their parents are treating them unfairly compared to their sibling. And I think doing whatever parents can do to encourage those positive relationships, spending time with each other as a family, but also giving them their own space and autonomy as well.
And thanks for that call. And just in our last minute, Anna, she mentioned she was the, I think, third of four. Another popular psychology thing, birth order matters. If you're the first kid or the seventh kid or whatever, it affects your personality. Just like some of the only childhood stuff, does research bear that out?
Not so much. Sometimes we might find that firstborn being a little bit more independent. But I think a big difference is the way that parents treat their children. So sometimes parents treat the first child as a first draft, and then they think about their younger children, and they learn from their experiences with their older ones. So there might be a little bit of truth to it, but not as much as we might think.
Anna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Anna Lindell, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater, where she researches child development and the role that parent and sibling relationships play in healthy development. She was with us today to talk about the role that having siblings or being an only child plays in our development over the years. Still time for you to share your own story, if you'd like, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or just give a shout out to a sibling, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.